everyone, and welcome. This is episode 324 of Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers Podcast, part of the MKE Tailgate Network. I'm James, joined by Ryan and Paul. We're doing this shortly after the Badgers just stolen for Purdue, basically, or stolen from the refs, I should say, more accurately.
Stole it back.
Ryan, yes. Stole it back, yes. Took what was rightfully theirs. Man, that was stressful. It was so stressful that even my fiance, who doesn't typically get invested in the sports, was getting anxiety from the end of that game. So, yeah, man, going from so frustrated with the foul situation to just elation at the end, it feels nice to actually steal one. Anyway, how are the rest of your guys' weekends going so far? Paul, I know you're maybe waiting for a cat to puke here.
Yeah, she's boiling, but we'll see if she actually boils over. She's 20 years old, and she does that sometimes. Doing well. Took my kids to the Blackhawks game last night, which means everybody's very tired, but that's okay. That's all right. And by the way, I do not follow the NHL at all and hadn't looked into how anybody was doing, but the Blackhawks are atrocious, and I've never seen any team get beaten as badly as they did by the Los Angeles Kings last night. Just wow. A full-on stomping completely. Kids had fun anyway, but man, they're bad.
Shiny helmets and all from the Kings.
Yep. Ridiculous. If you didn't see, I tweeted about it last night. Sorry, I'm being Matt for a second. The Los Angeles Kings last night were the worst helmets I've ever seen in any sport, and you should go look at the picture I've tweeted about them.
Yeah, it looked like Oregon football in the Rose Bowl, like that chrome look when they played the Badgers. That was atrocious. Oh, yeah, it was bad. It was
bad. Speaking of referees...
Right. Ryan, how you been? Yeah.
Well, I was yelling and screaming a lot. Living my best life with Liverpool right now. Things are going good on that end. So happy that things are going pretty good there. And this should be good. Also, four more days before a vacation. So four more work days before vacation. So that's also big thumbs up.
Always good. Always good to have that to look forward to. So this will be the second part of our three-part season preview series, our annual season preview series. If you missed last week, we covered the hitting side of things. So go back and listen to that one if you haven't already. Today, we'll be focusing on the pitching. And unfortunately, there's some not so great pitching news coming out of camp.
And how.
Yes, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But first of all, get our plugs out of the way. Go to patreon.com/mketailgate. That's where you can sign up to become a patron. $2 a month guarantees question priority both on this and on reporting as eligible as we get ever closer to the NFL draft. $5 gets you that perk plus the additional exclusive content, including that minor league extra with Ryan and James Anderson from RotoWire. Even if you're not a patron, support us another way. Go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you are listening to us right now, and hit follow, subscribe, what have you. Leave a 5-star review, especially as we get closer to baseball season. We're seeing that interest tick up, and we'd love to kind of move up those charts, so to speak. So you can help us out that way as well. All right. So I didn't mean to maybe jinx Devin Williams at the end of last week's episode when we had just heard about the back soreness, but maybe I did. I don't know. As I mentioned, fitting that we're talking pitching this week because that was the biggest news out of camp. Brewers, yeah.
I'm just impressed that I think last week when that rumor surfaced, all of our worst case scenarios were probably like bad back, might hurt his effectiveness, might knock him out for like months, whatever. Not he's gonna miss half the season and probably won't be with the team very long after that. Like it's kind of done. It was nuts.
Yeah, the timeline makes things tricky with the trade deadline and everything like that. But like you mentioned, a pair of stress fractures revealed in his back, which not great. And he's sort of been battling that soreness for a while, apparently dating back to the end of last season. And nobody detected stress fractures on the Brewers staff. He had to go to a outside opinion. Apparently the doctor that fixed Brook Lopez's back, which is a scary thought for us to think about. And he's like, yeah, there are two stress fractures there. Not great. So, first of all, how concerning is this? You know, whether it's just the loss of Devin Williams at the back end of the bullpen, or Paul, how we got here? Because how do you not pick out stress fractures in the back of your star closer?
Well, the back is hard, but it's not a good look for the Brewers. And Devin Williams called out the team medical staff and team doctors two days ago, by saying something along the lines of, yeah, it was good to get this fixed once I got in front of doctors who knew what they were doing. So,
I missed that. He used those words.
Yeah.
Oh, that's not good.
That was not maybe exact, but the words doctors who know what they are doing was used, and it was with a very salty delivery. So the relationship is not good there. It is bad. So, yeah, it's very bad situation. The Brewers, of course, have a deep bullpen and can absorb the loss of guys in the bullpen, but it's hard to replace Devin Williams. He's the best closer in baseball, or one of the top three or so. And it probably damages the relationship enough that he's probably, A, probably not coming back to the team, and B, probably is enough to hurt their leverage a little bit. Like, not a ton, but at least a little bit.
Well, nobody was expecting Devin Williams here past, well, I mean, at the very latest, 2025. They weren't going to give him an extension. That was never going to happen. Giving a top flight closer, reliever, a big money market extension, this is not going to happen. That's not how they roll. And frankly, it's not how they should roll, because they don't need to with how they develop up relievers. I mean, they've had a steady stream of good high-end relievers for a long time now. So it doesn't make sense to invest your money in that way, in giving these guys long-term extensions. You don't pay for relievers if you can help it. Like, that's why you have a development pipeline, is to do that. The concerning part of this is, yeah, the saltiness of the reaction to it, and the fact that the team doctors didn't get it. I mean, specialists do exist for a reason. So, like, you go see specialists when they do that. But the fact that the team doctors didn't catch it, or didn't apparently tell him to go consult, like they were telling him he was fine. Like, we don't know exactly how that all worked out and how that was said. But I mean, he's clearly not happy.
I pulled the exact quote. It's from a piece Kurt did and interviewed Devin on March 15th, which was, "I was glad to get in front of a doctor who knows what he's looking at."
Yeah. Okay.
Yikes.
Yep. Yeah.
Not
so he is
great.
He's clearly mad about it. And yeah, so I don't know what this means for when he does come back to the team, how quickly they potentially deal him. I don't know if they, I at this point wouldn't expect to see him on the 2025 Brewers. I think that's almost a sure bet, right? Like, the way we weren't expecting Corbin Burnes to be on the 2024 Brewers, you know, a year ago or whatever. I think we could say that now. Whether or not he gets traded at this deadline probably just comes down to where they are competitively, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, if it, like we've been talking about with Willy Adames, right? Like, Paul, you mentioned last week, if they're kind of middling or not really threatening, maybe you look at that, and especially now, you know, with the situation with Devin Williams, maybe you try to get a little bit more for a reliever like you did, or were supposed to with the Josh Hader trade. And yeah, just kind of cut your losses here, especially if this doesn't end up being a great season. But as we mentioned, plenty of options behind him. So at least that's the good part, right? This is a very deep bullpen that the Brewers are working with this year. That kind of leads us to our first Patreon question from Jack Bushman, who's asking, so who's the new closer? Is it McGill, Uribe, by committee? Craig Counsell had a magic touch with the bullpen. Hopefully Murphy can do the same. So Ryan, what do you think? Who do you think, you know, opening day against the Mets, the Brewers have a 1 or 2 run lead. Who's there in the ninth inning?
Yeah, I'd be perfectly happy to just kind of play it with matchups for a while. I don't think you necessarily, I don't know that Uribe is ready yet for that role, in that there is like an added pressure, because this is one of those things where there is added pressure because everybody assumes there's added pressure. So it becomes its own self-fulfilling prophecy on that. And I think you probably don't need to do that. There's also some advantages to not having it be Uribe right away for, say, salary reasons down the road, like pushing a guy who you think is maybe going to be your best reliever into the you're getting saves role early on just increases the cost of that player down the road. So I don't think there's any pressing need for that. Plus, there's other guys ahead of him. I think I would rather go with Piamps or McGill, or, as Spencer Michaelis pointed out, and I'd co-sign this, just, you know, kind of run with a committee, or maybe a sort of a shaded committee where you're pushing it a little bit towards one side. The one thing that a true committee situation works best when you have like your two best relievers, like one is right-handed and one is left-handed, and then you're just playing like matchups, like who is going to face the good lefties that are in this lineup and who's going to, you know, come in and not face the lefties. You would do that. That isn't their situation because their best relievers, their best leverage relievers are right-handers, because I don't count Hobie Milner because I'm still waiting for that smoke and mirrors.
You don't want Hobie as a closer?
I mean, I don't want Hobie as a guy who faces right-handers with power, like ever. And when you're, if you're the closer, that means you're coming in and you're facing like whoever is up in the ninth. And that's just not, yeah. I want Hobie Milner deployed when there's left-handers he can shut down and right-handers you can sort of work around. You know what I mean? You don't ever want Hobie Milner having to throw to a right-handed batter needing to get him out, especially a good right-handed batter, because that probably doesn't end quite so well.
Agreed. I think what they should do is the committee thing and just not have anybody established. I do wonder a little bit, though, if fractured relationship with established closer plus Murphy being a little bit more old school, it just in naming people starters, generally speaking, does end with that happening. And we suddenly do get the like ascension of like bullpen roles. And my money would be on Piamps just because I feel like he's kind of more veteran-y than some of the other guys. And he's spent time as the setup guy and he's the natural to do that in the old school tradition. That'd be my wager as to who gets it. But I wonder if that's what ends up happening. I could see Murphy running a little bit more old school bullpen than we're used to. And if that happens, actually getting named closers with some regularity.
Yeah, I do wonder about that. The thing is, it's not necessarily going to be a huge departure from what Craig Counsell was doing, because Craig hasn't really run that mix and match bullpen thing since, what, 2018?
Yeah. Kind of ever since Hader made him.
Yeah, because even, you know, those years with Hader in 2021, 22, it was Devin Williams in the eighth, Hader in the ninth. They were running like a pretty set thing. Last year, it was most often, you know, Peguero into Piamps into Williams to end the game. They were running pretty set bullpens for a while now. It hasn't been the mix and match. Craig's just kind of throwing people out there the way it had been. So I don't think it's a huge departure necessarily, but I think we can probably expect some of that. We'll see how they decide that they want to handle it. I think the front office, judging by who's in it and the fact that Matt Arnold is running it and how Tampa has always handled this, you know, forever now, they probably would be perfectly happy mixing and matching. But we will see what the relationship ends up looking like between Murphy and the front office this year. That is one of the things we'll talk about that next week in the preview, I'm sure. That's one of the things I'm going to be watching really closely, is how well do they see eye to eye, and do we start getting, because Craig was pretty good about not, you never really heard Craig complaining. If he had complaints about what the front office expected from him, you never heard him. We'll see if that holds true with Murphy. I kind of suspect it might not. So we'll see.
Same.
Murphy would explain why he's not playing Brian Anderson for a month. Anyway, you guys mentioned some of the other guys behind Williams who might take up some of those higher leverage roles. So beyond the capital C closer, you know, there are a number of guys that really did well last year in high leverage. I guess, who do you see covering all the important innings that aren't the ninth, Paul?
There, I really do think it'll be mix and match to a large extent. I mean, they might end up with roles because maybe that's how we end up going. But the bullpen's so good. Like, this isn't an instance where you just have to pick guys out and give them roles and trust them. Like, I trust almost everybody in the bullpen to be effective in what they do, Hobie notwithstanding against opposite side pitching. But, like, Abner Uribe is just a closer in waiting. So, like, if he gets sort of middle inning high leverage situations, like a restricted fireman to start, I wouldn't be that surprised. That might be how I would actually go and use him to get out of tough situations, because that pitch is just unhittable. And like, you know, McGill throws gas as well. Milner is good at what he does. It really is just, I think you get your leverage guys and you get your platoon guys and you deploy them as the game develops, and then go to whoever gets the assignment in the ninth at this point. And I think that's kind of how it goes, but they're just all, this is the strength of the team. They're all amazing. and it is just deciding who your leverage order guys are and who your platoon guys are, and that's kind of it.
Yeah, if we're going with like a one man sort of like a one guy to be the closer, I think Piamps is a good shout there, because I kind of like McGill as a guy who could potentially go a little bit longer and maybe a little less often, you know, a hater from the other side sort of situation where he's maybe pitching, you know, 1 2/3 and then getting a couple days off in situations. I kind of like McGill for that reason, because I think he can do that, and I think he could be very effective at that. And then beyond that, like, Uribe is coming. Like, he is an incredibly talented pitcher. His numbers this spring don't look good because he had a blow-up outing that was really that was a catastrophe of, like, bad infield defense. Rhys Hoskins made two errors in that inning, and there was just all kinds of weirdness. His numbers this spring do not really match with what like how good the stuff is. So I think he's in that mix as well. So I think, you know, McGill, Piamps, and then Hobie Milner deployed properly. And I did go look up his numbers. He actually did have an OPS under 700 against righties last year, but his OPS against lefties was like 4-something. So he absolutely dominates lefties. That's his strong suit. He was just good kind of against everybody last year. I wouldn't necessarily expect that to hold, because that's not, you know, in keeping. But when you have two lefties with power coming up in an inning, if that's the eighth inning, yeah, I could see using Hobie Milner in those situations. But then there's, you know, there's lots of other guys who I could see sneaking into this that we'll talk about when we get into more of the bullpen depth in a minute. But there's other guys that, you know, I'm a big Vieira honk, and I think that
he could
potentially work his way into leverage here as well if he keeps, you know, showing out and doing well. So that's,
he has the best name.
Yes, like, he does.
Tiago Vieira. Yeah. Exactly. 80 grade name. I'm still a big Elvis Peguero fan. I kind of fell in love with him last year. You know, obviously just two pitch pitcher with the sinker slider, but that's all he needed, because, you know, according to StatCast, 95th percentile in chase rates, 97th percentile in barrel percentage. So lots of weak contact against him, and 92nd percentile in ground ball rate. All things I love to see in my relievers. So it wouldn't surprise me if he kind of worked into those higher leverage things, but also wouldn't be a surprise if he's kind of leaned on as the rubber R middle relief guy, right? Like, to kind of bridge the gap there as well. All right. Let's move on. We've kind of talked this offseason about how the bullpen construction at the start of the year could be somewhat limited by guys who are out of options. Always a consideration. You rarely get to just pick the best guys, because there are always going to be folks without options that you want to give a look at. So I guess, Ryan, is there anyone who might deserve to make the team out of camp that would start the year in Nashville just because they're a sorry soul who does have an option or two left?
Yeah, Peguero is, I think, a guy. This is also shouts to Spencer for this one, because he's been talking about this, that there's a pretty decent chance that Peguero ends up not making the opening day roster like he didn't last year, because they're trying to keep guys like, say, JB Bukauskas, who has been really interesting this spring. I want to mention him, because he is absolutely putting up, he has a 12-2 strikeout to walk ratio in 6 innings. He's also given up some hits, did allow a home run, I think, the last time out. So his numbers are inflated a little bit. He has a 6 ERA. But I mentioned earlier on that my big thing here is always looking at that strikeout to walk ratio. When you strike out 12 in 6 innings, you are missing some bats, and you're doing some work there. So I think that he's a guy, because he's out of options, I could see him getting on ahead of Peguero at least for a while to see if it sticks. You know what I mean? Like, that could actually make quite a bit of sense for them to go that direction. Yep. Evan McKendry, what is his option situation? I got to check Spotrac here and see where he's at, because he is a guy that they brought in this winter, and, or is he on a minor league contract? He's not on Spotrac.
Yeah, he was a minor league signing.
Okay, so yeah, so that's not a concern for him, but he's an interesting one as well from that perspective. Just kind of looking up and down the roster here. Bryce Wilson, who got absolutely shellacked in that game that felt like a hangover from the Devin Williams news game. And then you had, was it Murphy talking about the fact that the team really played like crap that day? But Wilson was the guy who started that game, and I don't know that he even got out.
I did want to bring him up because I feel like, yeah, of all of the bullpen pieces, he is the most likely to secretly not be good. Mm-hmm. Like, he was good last year. He had a good ERA. He won a lot of games for a bullpen guy. But, like, his FIPs have always been bad, and they've always tended to match his ERAs in the past with other teams, and it wasn't good last year. And I feel like there's, like, his underlying stats are just generally worse than a lot of the rest of the bullpen. Like, I feel like if there's a guy that's gonna turn into a pumpkin a little bit, it's probably him.
I 100% agree. I think that you can't, if there's anybody who was like good last year, who I would wonder how quickly they could potentially be off the roster. Like, I could see Bryce Wilson being off the roster. I mean, maybe not even potentially not making the roster if they decide.
I think there's a long shot there that he doesn't actually make the roster. I think that's possible.
And especially because he doesn't have the options. So they might just try to sneak him out. Now, he has things going for him. He's still really young. It's funny. You look at him and you're like, that dude doesn't look 26. But he's actually 26. But yeah, to your point, he doesn't strike out a lot of batters. It does not. Like, that is not in his game. And trying to get his DRA here on. Yeah, so last year for the Brewers, he put up a 2.58 ERA and a 4.81 DRA. So smoke and mirrors definitely is a concern here for Bryce Wilson. They got a good year out of him. They may decide they don't want to push their luck, but they clearly see some things in him. And he does, one thing he does do a really good job of is he doesn't, you know, walk a lot of batters. He does a pretty good job. So the strikeout minus walk is still not bad. It's 12.4. But when you start by striking out that few batters, that is potentially a problem.
Yeah. And a lot of his value to the team, whether it was in war value or, you know, not, it was sort of picking up a lot of bulk innings. And if you've got like Bukauskas, who has like a history of that too, maybe it's a little bit redundant and maybe you just move on from Bryce Wilson. Mm-hmm. I kind of agree there. All right, so we've also talked this offseason about how deep the bullpen is overall, but still, you know, among all the, you know, 10, 12 names we've mentioned already, there's always a guy or two who seems to be a nice surprise that we don't mention in these previews. So I guess, Ryan, do you have your eyes on anyone who could be in store for a breakout season in the bullpen? I don't know about you, but I've really liked Brian Hudson just because he's a literal giant. And again, 14 strikeouts and 8.1 innings, probably from the left side. Pretty good. He's an early favorite of mine. Who do you think?
Yeah, 14-2 strikeout to walk ratio. You had me right there, Brian Hudson. You had me right there. Over 8.1 innings. Unlike some like Bukauskas, who's giving up a 308 batting average. He has a 207 batting average. These things have to be taken with large grains of salt. Though I will say Hudson has been pitching early in games. He's not been pitching in the double A portion of these spring training games. So I do think there's potentially something there with Brian Hudson. I do. That was going to be the number one guy I brought up there.
He's fun.
Yeah.
I don't know why this is, but for some reason, I feel like tall works better with lefty than righty. Like, sure. That's probably nonsense. But when you get the lefty, I think it's the camera angle. It just looks like the ball has to travel no distance to get to home plate. And for some reason, tall righties just don't seem to have the same thing.
No,
he's fun. I like watching him a lot.
Tall lefties with awesome sliders too. Yep. Like, yeah, that's great.
Because McGill is 6'8 as well, right?
And yeah,
he's a big boy.
It looks different.
Yeah. There are some other guys here a little bit further down. I mean, we're going to talk about these guys when we get to the starting part too, but you know, DL Hall and Aaron Ashby are probably going to be in the bullpen at some point this season, you would think. And those guys are extremely interesting too. And potentially pitching in high leverage situations, maybe as bridge guys, you know, in the sixth and seventh inning with leads to get to the back end of the bullpen. You could definitely see that being a place where they work out. So yeah, there's more on them later, but yeah, that definitely stands out as a possibility. Also, Jacob Mizrowski by the end of the year could just be coming in as a complete shutdown reliever if he's not, you know, if they're not ready to say, you know, hey, we're making you a starter right now. So
yeah, if they do contend and get to that time period, he might be a real difference maker, like a real like, oh, and now nobody can ever score off of us again kind of guy. So that's fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, at him and potentially DL Hall in the same bucket, like DL Hall is he's kind of like a left-handed version of Miz in a lot of ways. So yep. Both guys are not comfortable at bats, not people you want to be, you know. They have a lot of really nasty arms. What they don't seem to have so much of is guys who are you're counting on to give them length, which is, you know, where we're headed next year. So that's the but they're make no mistake, they have a ton of guys who are super nasty and are going to make hitters miserable. It's just a question of how long can they do that in a given game.
For sure. I know if Spencer were here, he'd maybe give a shout to Bradley Blaylock, too. He's liked him since the moment that the Brewers traded Urias for him. Might be somebody to look out for the rest of the year. I think there's definitely a lot of intriguing, hard-throwing arms that, you know, by the end of the year may be kind of relied on. Because this time last year, we had no idea about Joel Piamps or Elvis Figueroa really being, like, those high-leverage guys. So definitely something to look out for. All right, so let's move to the starting rotation now, because obviously that's been the big focus all off season, basically up until the Devin Williams news. You know, we already had the presumed loss of Brandon Woodruff, even, you know, before he signed the deal, and now, you know, he's back in the fold, but very unlikely to actually be a starter, right? So we'll just kind of cross him off the discussion list here. And then, of course, we had the late offseason trade of Corbin Burns to the Orioles after we all kind of figured they had moved past that and we're going to roll with him. So that leaves, obviously, as everyone knows, Freddy Peralta at the top of the rotation. And I guess, you know, my question is, can we trust him in that role? He's obviously got the stuff, right? Like one of the league leaders in strikeouts last year, but he has had some durability questions kind of throughout his career because he's such a little dude. And, you know, he had the shoulder strength issues as recently as 2022. So I guess, Ryan, how good can he be and how good will he be this year? Considering all those things,
I would happily take the number that the depth charts Fangraphs projection has him at, which is 163 innings of 3.77 ERA and 3.1 wins. I would take that in a heartbeat, mostly because 163 innings from Freddie, you're doing pretty well. I think he could be better than that in terms of his production. If he's giving you those kinds of innings, I would expect, you know, probably a lower ERA than that, probably something that maybe starts with a 2 as opposed to a 3, but I would be perfectly happy with that as an outcome, and that would give them a solid guy up at the top of the rotation to kind of work around. I don't know how realistic, especially those innings are, to plan on that, but that would make me happy.
Yeah, he's coming off of a 165 inning season, and I think the answer to this is they are counting on him to do that, but you really can't count on him to do that because he has proven to be somewhat injury prone. And while he has been, generally speaking, over the long haul, a very effective pitcher and was so last year, he can bounce up and down a little bit in his effectiveness too, especially if he does try to pitch through things. So, like, Freddie's awesome, and I'm happy to have him in my rotation. But as the lead guy with a lot of question marks behind him, it's not my favorite situation that we've ever had on the pitching side.
Yeah, it's not ideal. You feel much better if Freddie Peralta is your number 2, or as he has been lately, your number 3. Like, obviously that. But when a guy like Freddie Peralta is your number 3, then you have like an embarrassment of riches in your starting rotation. More normal to have him be sort of a number 2. Suboptimal to have him be the number 1 guy. That's not what you want. But I think still can do there are a lot of teams that don't have a pitcher as good as Freddie Peralta on them. How many of them are contenders? It gets a little bit dicier, but there are a number of teams that do not have a pitcher as good as Freddie Peralta out there. So, I, a lot of the interaction I do with baseball, especially at this time of year, is listening to fantasy podcasts where they're talking about stuff like that. Freddie Peralta does come up as, you know, he's in that like second to third tier of starting pitchers for fantasy purposes, but definitely well within. If you're going by the definition of ace as being like one of the top 30 pitchers of baseball, he's that. Like there's no question he's that. But you know, a lot of people don't define ace necessarily that way. So, and then after that is where the precipitous drop off happens. So,
right,
you hope you get a good strong year from Freddie and that he's able to do it. But they do have to be careful with him not to over ask, not to over, like, if he needs to get shut down, he needs to get shut down. Like, just do it, and you know, count on your depth to sort of get you through.
Yeah, I think when people think of top of the rotation ace, right, you're expecting the Brandon Woodruff type where six or seven innings every single night out, right? But that's kind of going by the wayside in today's era. I mean, this is a time when Blake Snell has multiple Cy Young Awards averaging like 5.1 innings per start, you know? So maybe, you know, it's less about the bulk of the innings that he provides. And especially, I know we've got a question about this, but like the Brewers seemingly going back to the 27 outs philosophy type of thing, right? Like you might not get the volume, but the quality might be really good. Regardless of that, you know, looking beyond Freddie Peralta, Paul, you mentioned after him, plenty of question marks. What does it say about the state of your starting rotation when 37-year-old Wade Miley is your number two starter?
It's not great. And one thing I don't like to do generally is to be in a position with my baseball team where I have to string together a lot of if this goes right and if this goes right and if this goes right, then we might be good. That used to be what we did with the Brewers all the time in the dark ages of the C-League ownership group. And it usually doesn't work out because that, you know, statistics are such that when you have to combine a bunch of these together, a lot of them don't work out. So, Miley is, you know, the next best of the bunch, but he's kind of almost like a, even though he pitches completely different, like a Peralta light, where when he's completely right, he's extremely good, but he is very dicey in terms of always being right. He misses a lot of time, and it's entirely possible if he's not right, he can fall apart and just miss like huge chunks of the season. So Freddie is less dicey than that. But, you know, the upside on Freddie is like 160 innings, which is already cutting down on what you got from the big dogs before. And now you have Miley, who is much, much less likely to give you anything, even in that general vicinity. He's much more likely to give you 100 or less. So it's a gamble, and it would be nice if it paid off, because I feel like if they hit on the first two, they can fix a lot of whatever happens after that. But it's a really dicey situation having both of them at the top of the rotation. And Miley has this weird every other year thing that is not statistically significant, but we've caught the good ones. Regression to the mean might be lurking for us there too. So I like Wade, but I wish he was my fifth or fourth starter, not my second.
Yeah, last year going in as like your fourth starter, that was a much happier place to be with Wade Miley than this is. So yeah, it is dicey. There's an interesting thing here. I was just on the FanGraphs depth chart thing. What do you suppose depth charts has their rotation ranking within MLB in terms of projected WAR out of their FanGraphs WAR out of their rotation?
I guess pretty low, like 22.
Higher than that. I know this because it's
middle of the pack, but
it's,
yeah.
Yeah, it's come up on effectively while Ben Lindbergh has mentioned this a couple times. 17th. And
okay.
Because there's some depth there. And if you look, so they have Freddie projected at 3.1. And then after that, it's Wade Miley, 1.2. Colin Ray, 1.5. Robert Gosser, sure. 1.3. Jacob Junis, 1.6.
Ones. Yeah.
Yeah. DL Hall, 1.7. So it's literally the next five guys are all 1.something. And if that does work out that way, you can get through a season playing that way. And then, like, beyond that, you know, Joe Ross is giving you, they have him projected to give him something. They have Aaron Ashby giving them something. So there's like a path through here with this working. but it's all just so speculative. Like, you really do. This is a case where you're sitting there going, well, if this goes right and this goes right and this goes right. Fortunately, they do have some depth to be able to operate here, but how quality is any of that depth? I feel like if this ends up being like a decent unit, you're going to have something weird happen. Like Jansen Junk all of a sudden becomes a solid number four starter or something, which isn't, which sure. isn't insane. Like that's a perfectly, you know, like reasonable thing. Not super far off of his, what the projections are for him, but it's also not something you would like plan on. So you feel like something like that is going to have to happen for them to really work out well here.
Yeah. And then you get to the playoffs and get trounced by the Phillies because all those guys stink. So yeah. All right. Happier thoughts though, James. Price Trozen, Patreon. Question here asking about the next member of the rotation, Colin Ray. Price is saying here, Colin Ray's smoke and mirrors act is back, baby. Last year, he had 124.2 innings and being a designated starter without the yo-yo to AAA. I think a good back of the envelope math over under for innings is 155.5 for 2024. What do you guys think?
That's pretty good.
How many innings? Yeah, about that for Colin Ray?
I'll go slightly over on that. I think kind of just situationally they'll need to lean on Colin Ray and that he's more likely to be durable than a lot of the other guys in the rotation, the ones we've mentioned for sure. So I think he'll hit like 160-ish. I'd take a slight over on the 155. Even if he's like, so not the biggest Colin Ray fan, but his stuff can be effective, especially against like lesser lineups. And he's the closest thing they have to like an innings eater in the rotation, which they don't have. That's what they got. So I think he's fine. Again, I think he's overcast a little bit here. I wish he was my fourth or fifth, not my third, which is what I think he will be. I think he'll be third, but I think he'll hit higher than that. I think he'll hit like 160-ish.
Yeah, if he ends up being the guy who's second in innings on this team, that wouldn't surprise me at all. And it's not necessarily a bad thing either.
I wouldn't be surprised if he was first when it's all said and done.
Which he is the second highest returning pitcher in innings. Obviously, Corbin mm-hmm. Burns was first last year. Then it was Freddie. And then it was Colin Ray. So there you go.
Ray is projected by depth charts. Again, this is depth charts, 123 innings. I don't know. Did they have him throwing any out of the bullpen? I don't know. Probably not. Shouldn't be, I don't think. But anyways, yeah, he is a guy who's this spring has interested me. And I'm wondering if he might be on the verge of a kind of sort of maybe breakout, like late career breakout because he's old. But he's a 12-2 strikeout to walk ratio over eight innings and seems to be generating a lot of swings and misses. And that's the thing. Kurt mentioned it during during a start he had a few days back. And I can't remember what day that was, but he was generating a lot of swings and misses. And I think he was still basically just facing, this was against the Cubs. He was still facing a lot of their big league hitters and generating whiffs. So when guys start generating whiffs, that's when you start to have my interest peaked. And so, yeah, I think we could be, and when I say a breakout, I'm not talking about like the guy all of a sudden becoming like an all-star or something. I'm talking about him becoming, you know, a guy that you're pretty happy with as your third starter.
Yeah.
And I could see that happening, and that's fine. So yeah, Ray is a guy I am cautiously optimistic about this year, and I'm have good feelings on him going into the season.
When I think about it, like Colin Ray is sort of Wade Miley-ish in mm-hmm. that, like, you know, they were sort of, you know, hyped-ish prospects in their younger days that never really quite mm-hmm. lived up to that, and then they get into their 30s and suddenly they're an effective pitcher. So the parallels there are kind of interesting to me. Mm-hmm. Obviously the Brewers this offseason did ink a couple of, you know, like spaghetti on the wall type starters in Jacob Junis and Joe Ross. So I guess, you know, what are your guys' expectations on those two guys? Who do you see sticking as a starting pitcher? Who ends up in the pen or even off the roster? I know Pat Murphy seems to be in love with Jacob Junis so far. Ryan, how do you see those inning situations, you know, working out?
We talked about this when we signed Junis, that I think he is a very good fit for having an opener and potentially being put in a situation where he's pitching sort of the middle innings, where maybe he comes in the second or third inning and then is, you know, kind of going as deep as he can there. And probably at that point, you're hoping to get him like through the sixth at that point, if he, you know, only starts in the second. And I think that could really work. Because he's such an overwhelming slider guy, you just don't want to count on him to be facing guys a third time. Like, you really, as much as possible, don't want to be asking him to have to face batters a third time. So, and you'd prefer maybe not to have him face really good batters more than once. And if you use the opener, you could potentially maybe be able to find ways that he only has to face the top of the lineup once, and you could still get him through, you know, 4 to 5 innings. So that might be the best play for him. We'll see. That's not a thing that they did much under Council, but is definitely something that comes out of the DNA of how they do stuff. Ross is much more speculative and has been underwhelming in spring training. I don't know how much we want to read into that. It is a bit interesting here. There was just a tweet I put in the rundown here from Dominic Contronio, talking about saying Pat Murphy wouldn't commit to his opening rotation behind Freddie, or whether it's 4 or 5 pitchers deep. He did say once the 13 in a row stretches begin, the team is looking to be a 6-man rotation, which is not surprising. But I do want to point out here, the Brewers opened the season playing 5 games in 8 days. So they can get away with not having to necessarily test the depth. And they might, some of these guys may come in and pitch in like middle innings early on just to get their feet wet and get their feet under them before they actually have to start really starting games once they start getting into not having off days all the time. But they do start with a ton of off days. So that's something to keep an eye on for early in the season. They may not have to. I think Freddie might legitimately start opening day and then start the home opener because he'd have four days rest in between. So yeah. I think it legitimately could happen.
That does seem pretty likely. Like, Ross is just complete speculation. He's got such a weird profile. I assume the result of, you know, speculating, seeing something they could maybe work with, kind of Matt Bushy, but I haven't seen what that is. So he's the one where if he ends up not making the team, I wouldn't be that surprised. I'm not impressed so far.
For sure. Moving on. Back end, or at least younger guys could maybe backfill, or as Ryan mentioned, be part of that 6-man rotation. How do Aaron Ashby and DL Hall figure into the rotation mix? Should we be expecting to see them in the bullpen instead, or could they fill in spot starter situations, or even just grab a rotation spot outright? Paul, what do you think?
I think possibly yes, but probably not. Hall, I think, has to, that it would take like something clicking, like an immediate upgrade in consistency. That happens sometimes, but stuff wise I think they'll probably let him work on consistency out of the bullpen first. You know, leverage the great stuff, minimize the lack of control he sometimes has, and let him work on it there. Maybe they'll give him like a cup of coffee start every now and then when the rotation needs a break, just to test it out. But I would expect him to be primarily out of the bullpen. I kind of think the same with Ashby, but I'm less certain on him. It's kind of a different situation where they've kind of had their look there a little bit off and on. But I think there are too many guys ahead of them to project them making the rotation outright. I think at best both of them end up starting a couple games here and there, but mostly bullpen for both of them, I'd say.
Yeah, I think one of them is going to have to make some starts, I think. I don't know which one it is, and it's going to depend kind of on how healthy is Aaron Ashby's shoulder. Where is he with that sort of situation? One of these guys, I think, is going to have to make some starts.
I still think they grab an innings eater, which is mostly why I think that.
Yeah, that could be when it gets to cut down day, though. Everybody is looking for innings at this time of the year. So I think that is kind of a, we'll see what is actually available out there, how that how that shakes out. But I think one of them is going to have to at least give you 3 to 4 innings sometimes, whether or not that's starting or maybe as a bullpen guy, as a one of these sort of swingmen sort of situations. Somebody's going to, one of these two guys, I think, is going to end up giving them some length. I think you're going to kind of have to give them some length. So, well, we'll see. But yes, at some point, adding a guy who can give them some length is going to happen. I just don't know if that can happen before spring training ends, because you know how it is. Like, it's
yeah.
Everybody's looking for innings this time of year.
All right. You know, those two guys probably, you know, well, not probably. They are no longer considered prospects. They've graduated off prospect lists, I should say. But looking ahead, Ryan, are there any pitching prospects with their eligibility intact that could make their way onto the pitching staff at points this year, whether it's in the rotation or in the bullpen? I know you mentioned Miz. What do you think about Robert Gosser, some of those other guys?
So Robert Gosser has thrown more innings for the Brewers in spring training this year than anybody else so far. Some of that is just he's gotten into 4 games so far, and it's him and Bryce and Brian Hudson who've gotten into 4 games, and then Bukauskas, who's pitching purely as a reliever here. So that's part of the reason. But Gosser looks pretty good. 11-2 strikeout to walk ratio. You know, I'm a sucker for that. And like, is limiting hard contact, has given up a home run, but I think, let me put it this way. I don't expect Robert Gosser to open the season on the squad. I would be kind of surprised if he wasn't on the squad by the end of April. So I was
going to ask, is he starting games for the Brewers in May?
I think there's a pretty strong chance of that. And yes, this all, like, straight up, that it reeks of service manipulation. Like, all they have to do is keep him down for a couple weeks. And frankly, with the way that they are set up with having all these off days.
With those off days, they don't need deep starters, right?
Right.
They can keep them off easily.
They can afford to have them start a couple games in AAA. And
baseball
then,
schedulers are definitely not doing that on purpose for service manipulation purposes.
Yeah, this one was especially funny because there's no reason the Brewers needed to open on a Tuesday and have Monday off. Like, obviously, with the Mets situation, because they're playing in New York, they gave that Thursday game and then the Friday off because they're trying to protect that opening day ticket. Like, that's what they do when you're potentially looking at rainouts or snowouts for opening day. There's no need to do that in Milwaukee. You don't have to do this. But they weirdly decided to have the Twins open. It's just a bizarre situation where it's the Twins who are opening, but because it's only, you only play against your rival, you only play the two home and homes, you end up with it being a 2-game series, which means they had to have an off day somewhere. So they stuck it right there. And so, and then there's the off day after it too. So they have the off days on Monday and on Thursday. And then they don't actually start getting into like back-to-back 3-game series without off days until starting with the Mariners that weekend. So yeah, they did them this favor, and it is going to set it up that they can probably bring Robert Gosser up right after he gets past, the 16, 17 days he needs to be down. They'll bring him up, and then, you know, they get the extra control year on him. So,
yeah,
it is what it is. That's how the system is set up.
Yeah, my assumption is Gosser will be, like, a key part of the rotation, and, like, by June, we'll just be thinking of him as a normal part of the basic portion of the rotation.
Sure.
Outside of service manipulation, that would happen right away.
Yep, I think so. I think that's 100% right. And yeah, we'll see. Maybe wait and see if he signs an extension. If there's a last second extension, and then all of a sudden
let's Cheerio this puppy.
Yeah,
exactly. Then he's, that's the motivation.
Yeah, we'll see. It's fine. Robert Gosser is not a guy that you would worry about setting up this way for potentially losing the for losing the prospect eligibility. And also, I should point out, because he's not on the top 100 prospect list, he also wouldn't qualify for it. So Robert Gosser could not potentially bring back, if Gosser were to go out and shove and have, you know, hit his 90th percentile or 99th percentile projection and end up winning rookie of the year, they couldn't get a pick out of him anyway because he's not on those lists, which is dumb. And that needs to be gotten rid of. That is some stupid stuff. I don't know why they do that. That's dumb.
At the very least, hey, Nashville, you're going to get a couple of Robert Gosser starts before May. So there's that at least. Yeah. Okay. We do have some Patreon questions this week that aren't about any specific pitcher, so let's get to those. Michael Parr is asking, how many pitchers will get over 100 innings for the Brewers this year? They will need at least six without Burns eating 200, won't they? So Paul, this is kind of interesting to me. How many guys do you think go over 100 as they just try to piece together 27 outs every night?
Yeah, that is a good one. So Peralta, Miley, if it goes well, Ray, I think Gosser, yes. And then you get into spot starters and long relief and guys like Joe Ross, and somebody's gonna have to do it. So they probably get six. They might, like, they almost have to, as how things function, but I don't know who else is gonna be.
Again, I'll go to my depth charts cheat sheet here, and they have Peralta, Miley, Ray, Gosser, Junis all getting at least 114 innings.
Yeah, Junis probably will. That's definitely true. Okay.
And then the wild card is some of the projection systems on FanGraphs, not Zips, but some of the projection systems on FanGraphs, like Steamer. Steamer expects 125 innings out of DL Hall. The FanGraphs depth charts expects 110 total innings. So some of those, again, are in the bullpen. Some of them are in the rotation. Some are in the bullpen. But Zips only has them at 76. But Zips depth charts has them at 96. So he's kind of right around that point. Hall is going to be an interesting one. If you can get Hall up into the 90s, I think that's, you know, you're starting to get a good chunk of the way there towards being able to eat up these innings. I think this is a situation where if they are contending, if they are doing well, they're probably going to want to add pitching a guy who can start games for them down the stretch. Unless some things have gone fabulously well that we aren't expecting. This team, if they're contending, is going to be looking for starting in a way that the Brewers haven't really been looking. When's the last time they brought in a starter? I guess it'd be 2019, right? When they brought in.
Right. I was going to say you're looking at a Jordan Lyles type addition where they were desperate at that point.
Gio. I was going to say Lyles and Gio kind of came
technically in Pomerantz, but not actually Pomerantz.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You know, that was your first appearance on this podcast, Paul, I think, was when you came in and talked about Pomerantz. Yeah. I think that was your first appearance on the pod.
Aw, that's a nice little memory.
Yeah, I just remember that.
Long ago? Oh my God.
Yeah, we've been doing this a while, man.
Well, you guested. I think James came and guested once before, but I think.
Yeah, or 2020.
Yeah, I think you came and guested once. I think Paul was a few times because you had started reporting as eligible before you joined here full time when Steve and Jim left. So, yeah. Anyway, sorry, that was a sidetrack, but. Yeah, a long time now. You pointed this out, James. We're 324 episodes, and that is now we're more than halfway of 2.0. So the James-Paul era as opposed to the Steve-JP era, you guys now have more episodes in than they did at the beginning.
It's wild to think about. Doesn't seem like that. Sorry, we got off the rails here, but I should mention, too, Michael has a second question that I was going to save for Ryan because I assume because I don't recognize these names that these are soccer names. Uh-huh. So Michael's second question is also in an alternate world, are you starting Trent Alexander-Arnold over Serginho Dest?
So you should know Serginho Dest because he is a Team USA player who is currently out on loan from Barcelona. He was on Barcelona, out on loan to PSV Eindhoven, and is a critical part of the U.S.'s thing. Now, the last time we saw him play for the U.S., he was throwing a temper tantrum and getting tossed from the game. Really, really bad situation. He like it was embarrassing for him. He like threw a temper tantrum and got tossed from a game, and it was bad. Trent Alexander-Arnold is currently hurt. He's been hurt quite a bit, but when he's healthy, he's one of the best right backs in the world, and he is Liverpool's long-term investment, like really good player, and was like one of the best right backs in the world as like a 20-year-old. So he's hurt right now, but it's Trent. It's pretty clearly Trent. Though Connor Bradley, shouts to Connor Bradley for being so good in Trent's absence. He has saved their bacon this season. Liverpool has had to rely on a lot of teenagers to get through a bunch of injuries this year, and they have all come up big for them. It's been kind of amazing to watch. When I say teenagers, there's been 17 and 18 year olds who've been like scoring goals in cup competitions. Like it's been wild. So yes, Trent over Serginho Dest, but I do like both of them if Dest can get his head on straight.
Okay. Quite Suitcase asking, is this the year the Brewers pitching lab magic finally runs out? It seems like most teams have one at this point. So where do you see their advantage being with pitching if there is one? Paul, this is interesting because, everybody has a pitching lab now. Everybody's working on, just creating pitches in the lab. So how long do the Brewers really have an advantage here?
I think they still have an advantage in terms of how their development tends to work out. They tends to generate really good pitchers. And I think that there's no reason to expect that to stop. Their bullpen is testament to that. Their problem is just that they've hit this juncture due to injury to Woodruff and Burns just being too good, honestly, where they're going to run into a problem just covering all the innings. To the extent they have a problem with pitching this year, it's going to be one of fatigue and attrition more than talent. And the league is there to the lab is there to develop talent, not necessarily to crank out guys who can reliably get six innings a start. That's just difficult to do. It's, a lot of this is just the modern fact that what labs are really good at is getting guys who would have previously gotten hurt to still be effective throwing gas for sometimes shorter amounts of time. And they could really use a hit on some starters who can eat some innings. But this year, they don't have that. So they're still going to throw a ton of talented guys out there. But I think they're going to run into some real problems with fatigue and occasionally just having to run out guys. AAA guys who aren't prospects every now and then. And it could get even worse than that if they lose a starter or two who actually is worthwhile. So the lab is fine, and it's still generating an advantage over a lot of other teams. But, man, they need some guys to cover innings really bad.
Yeah, so what the lab is good for, besides you're absolutely right about the health thing and being able to kind of monitor guys and see how that's going, because that's a big part of this. But what they're good at is turning non-big leaguers into sort of marginally useful big leaguers, turning marginally useful big leaguers into big leaguers, turning big leaguers into maybe kind of good big leaguers, and turning maybe kind of good big leaguers into good big leaguers. Like they're good at nudging the line up on each sort of category and bumping guys up a little bit. And the thing is, this year they're asking the pitching lab to do work in a way that they haven't really in quite a while here. They're falling back on this, and they're saying, we're counting on our ability to turn guys and make them a little bit better here and a little bit better there. They're counting on that ability to get them through in a way that they haven't at least since like 2018-19. So they're leaning on it harder than they have in the past, and that is quite possibly going to stress it to, I don't want to say the breaking point, but the point where people start going, oh, we really have a pitching problem here, which hasn't been the case for this club in, 7-8 years, where we're like, oh, we really have a pitching problem here, because they've had enough to sort of cover. So this is the test of that capacity, and they're pushing it. They're asking it to do a lot of heavy lifting this year, and whether or not it is going to work and they're up to the task, I don't know. At some point, you're probably going to push it too far, and you're going to end up legitimately having to have like bad pitchers pitching important innings for you in a way that we haven't seen bad pitchers have to be pitching a lot of important innings for us in quite a while. And that might be a pretty big shot of cold water to people if that is what this ends up being. I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm saying that the possibility, they're stretching it. They're pushing it.
Remember 2014? Yeah, that was not fun. Yeah. All right. Tricky Henderson, our next question, saying, our former skip, I believe he went by Gregory Counseling, received massive credit for his quote-unquote ability to plug and play the Brewers pitching staff. Do you believe that, one, that Gregory was really the method beyond the madness? Two, or did an Academy Award-style sealed envelope arrive from upstairs each game with the plan? Three, finally, what's Murphy's Law going to be regarding the pitching? Thank you for all the continued crew service. Always worth a listen. So, Paul, how much of the Brewers', you know, overperformance with pitching was counsel versus just front office philosophy?
Oh, I think that Craig was the unifying force between all major aspects of baseball, former player, former front office manager. And I believe he did get an envelope every day with what he was supposed to do. And one of his great skills was an ability to implement it generally while keeping the clubhouse together and keeping players on board, with obvious exceptions like Hader wanting to be a closer, like the last few seasons with guys starting to get hacked off. You know, there's a limit to everything. But I think Counsell was important for that. And I don't know that Murphy will be able, A, able to implement it as well, and B, have the desire to implement it as well. Because when the manager is, you know, in the clubhouse, or not the in the dugout, he can kind of do whatever he wants and get yelled at later. But this, I think, will be a little bit different. And on number three, I think we'll see Murphy mostly doing what the Brewers do, running an analytically correct ship. But I do think Craig was very good in the moment decisions on getting it right. And I won't be surprised if that gets worse. And I'm going to wager that we'll get a couple of gut calls every once in a while, where after the game we'll get, oh yeah, I decided to stick with him one too long a pitch because my gut said to. I think that'll start to happen a little more too. Don't know that for sure, but I would wager that it does.
That all sounds very right to me. I would just add that, like, Craig had a deft touch. He had a feel for it. And I don't know how much it's probably lost to the mist of time now, how good his touch was in 15, 16. I can't really remember back that far, even 17. Like, he didn't, I think it took some time for him to develop that deft touch is what I'm saying. I think he had a good feel for how guys would work and to get guys out at the right time and to do those sorts of things. And whether Murphy has that, I have no idea. Murphy may have played some role in that because Murphy was, after all, you know, standing right next to Craig Counsell for the last 8 years, and they definitely discussed things going in. But there's also the fact that the guy who's actually in charge of the pitching staff is still there, right? Chris Hook is still on this squad, and he's still, you know, potentially running things. So I don't know how much is going to change from that. But I agree with you 100%. He was definitely getting information from the front office, and he was really good at implementing it and really good at making that medicine go down, even when, like, the Josh Hader thing. It does seem to have been the call of Craig Counsell that they were just going to use him as a saves guy, because that's what he wanted, because Craig wanted to keep harmony in the clubhouse. And so, like, I think those sorts of things are what you wonder what's going to change with Murphy. Like, you worry about how well he's going to implement, how well he's going to keep people happy. And yes, we did see cracks in the facade of the overall happiness of the Brewers, especially the pitchers lately. And that's, as Paul said, that's inevitable, but you do wonder about that. But yeah, I think for the most part, he's been saying the right things. I've been heartened by what he's been saying in spring training. I mentioned this a few weeks ago about the outgetters thing. He does seem to have some of that philosophy. So now, will it survive? You know, what is the thing? Everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. We'll see how well that holds up once the fur actually starts flying in the regular season. But I'm cautiously optimistic that he's going to be at least somewhat progressive about how he deploys guys, but we'll have to see.
I am totally down for the Murphy's Law puns and references when things go awry this year. That is going to be a thing. Anyway, we do have some Patreon questions this week that aren't related to the pitching, but we should get to because speaking of things Pat Murphy said this week, Mark Podscarby asking, Pat Murphy announced Bryce Terang as the opening day second baseman this week. Paul's already shaking his head. Do you think he realized the Mets plan to start a lefty or is Terang going to be an everyday guy this year and not get platooned? So of course, the Mets announced that famous Brewer killer Jose Quintana starting opening day because of course he is.
Because of course he is.
Yeah. Paul, what do you think about Bryce Terang kind of already being penciled in as the everyday second baseman?
My guess is he did that as a confidence booster because it offers no advantage other than that. Like, you don't need to fill in your opening day lineup till the day before. You can, and whatever, maybe we're being a little too literal there, and we should read that as the starting second baseman, which fine. But it sure sounds like he's going to at least get a chance to play absent platoons, despite all of the problems that Bryce Terang brings to the table. Which, I don't know. Why would you do that with so much information yet to glean and so much spring training left to go and having, like, other guys who can play the position? I think it's just to boost his confidence to see if you can get a little extra development out of Terang. I wouldn't read too much into it. And if he doesn't start on actual opening day because the platoon is bad, I wouldn't be that surprised. But it's kind of weird and kind of a change from, I think, what Craig would have done in the past. And I'm not, I don't know. It's, I don't like old timey Murph stuff. And this strikes me as that. So it annoys me on a personal level.
Yeah. This seemed like a situation where it was like nobody. And then Pat Murphy says, Bryce Terang is our starting second baseman. You know, it like it came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Like what purpose does this serve other than what Paul said, which is maybe to give him a boost of confidence or whatever. I'm fine with the notion that Bryce Terang is going to play a bunch here because I think there's still some upside and some possibility, but they need to be ready to curtail that and pull the plug and dial it back relatively quickly, at least as long as they're trying to contend this season. Now, there might come a point this season where contention is no longer the goal, and if that does become the situation, then you do want to play Bryce Terang, you know, as much as possible, get him out there, get a bunch of guys out there as much as possible to kind of let them develop and see what they have. But it is, this is weird. And I do think, like, that I wonder if this is one of those situations where he was speaking off the cuff and like 5 minutes after this happened, Matt Arnold came down and was like, hey, Murph, we're probably facing a lefty at opening day, so that could be a problem. But ultimately, it doesn't really matter. This is about who is going to see the lion's share of things and how quickly they're going to be willing to move on from guys, you know, and to make that try to go over with in the clubhouse. That's going to be a big challenge here. Craig was good at it. We'll see how Murphy is at it.
My Only Lemonade has a follow-up question to this topic, asking how much would Terang need to hit in order to be a viable everyday player? Zips has him projected for an 80 WRC plus over 539 plate appearances, resulting in 1.5 Fangraphs WAR. Would that be enough? And is that a realistic projection? Paul, what do you think?
It's probably realistic. Like a small uptick in contact probably gets him to about that. And that probably does make him like maybe a hair below average, but close to that probably makes him playable, honestly, because his running and his defense are so good.
Sure.
But like it's still not great. So it's like a reasonable projection, and I'm not sure he'll meet it.
it's a lot of plate appearances. Yeah.
But aside from just the vacuum analysis of having an 80 OPS plus second baseman, there's competition on the team from other people who can play second base and are likely to hit better than that, which is what makes it kind of weirder that he was declared starter so quickly. So, yeah, that probably makes him playable. That probably makes him like a, I don't know, like a 2 WAR guy, something like that. But it's still not great. It's just better than the 62 OPS plus he had last year. That's all.
Yeah, I think it makes him a guy that is playable as a starter, but not a guy that you necessarily want to hand over an everyday no doubt job to, right? Like, this is, it makes you playable, but it doesn't make you an ideal player to have, as James pointed out, like almost 600 plate appearances. I think that's pushing it at that point. He does give you the flexibility of being a great defender and the speed and all that. That does help a lot, but this is a first division regular versus a second division regular situation, right?
Yeah, yep, totally.
And it's also a situation of like, well, it depends on how your team is constructed and how you're if they are actually getting really good production offensively from the top end of the lineup. And I think that is potentially in the cards here. I think they might have a really good top 5-6 spots in the lineup offensively in a way that we haven't seen in quite a while this year. Okay, I think that's a possibility. And if that does bear fruit, if that is what happens, then I think you are potentially legitimately looking at, well, from a team construction standpoint, you can handle having a guy who's a below average hitter as long as he plays really good defense. And is it too bad offensively down at the bottom of the lineup? You can handle it. So from a it sort of becomes a roster construction situation. I think that it is reasonable. I'm trying to get the Pecota projections up here because why can't I find, there it is. Okay. They have him with how many plate appearances do they have? 459. So fewer, but still actually a pretty hefty amount there. But they have him with 0.1 warp as opposed to 1.5. So they do think a lot of his defense over at Fangraphs. So that is, I think, driving a big part of that. And he is a great defender. I mean, you just watch him and you can see he's a really good defender at second base. So, yeah. But I think him starting that much is not ideal. That's not what you want. But could it work? Potentially, it could be okay.
I think the only way he gets that many plate appearances is if Willy Adames is traded and then Joey Ortiz is playing shortstop, right? Like, otherwise, I at least hope there's a bit more of a split between Ortiz and Turang at second base, but who knows how that'll play out. All right,
James, I did want to point out, C. Trent Rosecrans just did a profile of Pat Murphy. Actually, it was from 2 days ago. So if you haven't seen this yet, it's worth checking out. It popped up on my feed just while we were recording here. So, hey, the Athletic is actually covering the Brewers, but they're having their Cincinnati guy come over and do a thing about the Brewers.
Yeah, so. I missed the dedicated reporter.
Yes. Anyway. Yeah. Well, especially, we had a really good one. Like, he was
really good couple. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway,
from the Athletic. Yeah. Okay.
Anyway. Yep. Real quick, last couple of Patreon questions, not related to pitching, as we are way over time already. Jay Google asking, who are the odd men out in the infield and outfield? Weimer to start at AAA? Does Black go to AAA as well? Ryan, obviously still some camp left to kind of make those decisions. What do you think?
Black almost certainly to AAA because he's not on the 40 man and they don't want to push that any quicker than they need to. Same deal with Gosser. Like, he's not on the 40 man. So that also makes it just easier to send the guy down. But I think we do see Tyler Black relatively quickly. I think both of them we see, you know, well before June. Weimer is a tougher one. I don't know exactly where things stand with that. I still lean towards yes, especially if Frelick is actually going to be playing some at third base.
Right.
Part of the plan is that Frelick's going to be seeing substantial time at third base. Joey Weimer's on this team. But I don't know exactly where that stands. So Black, no. Weimer, likely, yes. So then who are the odd men out? I mean, Tyler Dunn, probably. Tyler Dunn.
Oliver Dunn.
Not Tyler Dunn. Different guy entirely. He's probably out, I would say. Who else figures to be out? Monasterio might be out.
Yeah, might be one of the last couple hard decisions to make. Yeah.
Jake Bowers is.
Oh, he gone. Yeah.
Well, is he? He might be, but he might also not.
Owen Miller is still on the team, right?
Somehow, yeah.
Can we not do that?
I would appreciate not doing that, but Owen Miller is a guy that, like, very smart managers. And far be it for me to say nice things about Greg, but, like, He and Francona both loved playing Owen Miller way more than the fans could stand. Like, this was both
because Council and Tito were both like utility guys, right? So utility guys love scrappy utility guys.
Yes. Yeah. This is, yeah. There's something about this, but, you know, also, you know, something about the history of syphilis.
All right. Steve S., last one. And this is a long one, so bear with me, but we'll try to kind of summarize this neatly. Asking, here are some teams that have former Brewers on various kinds of contracts. Which team's group will have the most combined WAR at the end of the season, and which group will have the least? And yes, negative contributions count negatively. So the Orioles have Corbin Burnes, Colton Wong, Julio Teheran. The Pirates have Yasmani Grandal, Rowdy Tellez, Andrew McCutchen, Chase Anderson, and I think Willie Peralta. The White Sox have Mike Moustakas, Martin Maldonado, Jake Cousins, Corey Knebel, and Brett Phillips. These are some surprises to me as I'm just reading them live on the air. Astros, Josh Hader, Vic Curatini, Mauricio Dubon, John Singleton, Athletics, Lucas Ursag, Trevor Gott, Abraham Toro, Esturi Ruiz. So of those groups, Paul, who has the most WAR? Who has the fewest?
I think it's a good, like, the obvious way is to go with Burns, but there's a good chance of getting some serious negatives from the other. Here's the thing. I suspect there's a cap on what both Wong and Teheran can do there. So the answer is the Orioles, because as soon as they become a drag, they're just gone. They might not make the team. So I'm going to go with the Orioles and Burnes leading the way there, because there's not an overwhelming WAR guy outside of that anywhere else. Like, Grandal's days of that are over. Moustakas is like, what, 50 years old now? I guess the Astros, Hader and Caratini could maybe put up a challenge to that.
Dubon's good defensively.
Dubon is good defensively. So that's probably number two. If that won, I guess I wouldn't be that surprised. And I guess the negative side's kind of tricky too, because like Tellez and Grandal could put up positives, and who knows about the Athletics guys. I guess I'll go with the A's, because they're A's.
I mean, anyone who's bad is going to get DFA'd pretty quick too. That's what makes this tricky to me. I guess maybe the White Sox, but like also like a bunch of those guys are just DFA fodder at this point. But also the White Sox will suck, so who knows?
The White Sox are going to be terrible, and they'll probably have a couple of those guys actually be on the team. I just feel like on the A's, you'll get everybody playing to some extent, maybe. Maybe not, though.
I think it's
a tough call.
I think the White Sox, because they're actually bad and will let some of these guys just
they're dumb
soak
too.
Up
That's
playing
a good call.
Time. Well, it just because they just don't have better options, because they're so bad, and they're just such a shittily run organization that like I could see them being the bottom. The Orioles, you're right, because there's a cap on how bad Wong and Teheran can actually be for them before they're just off the roster. The Pirates one, I giggle at the fact that he's listing McCutchen as a former Brewer in the context of it being a Pirate. Like, McCutchen is
technically true, which is the best kind of true.
It is the best kind of true. That is correct. The Athletics one is interesting, because Ruiz could potentially be, some of this comes down to which WAR are you looking at, because Ruiz grades very differently depending on which defensive metrics you're using, because Fangraphs did not think he was very good defensively, which is kind of remarkable for a guy that's that fast. How are you not, if you're that fast, how are you not just like a really good center fielder? But there's more to it than just that. But there's a lot of, so the problem with the Athletics upside, and actually a lot of the upside here, so many of these guys are relief pitchers that it's just hard to accrue much WAR when you're either positive or negative. I guess it's easier to accrue negative WAR, but it's hard to accrue positive WAR when you are a relief pitcher, just because you're not pitching enough to like really start racking up numbers.
Right. Like, what's Hader's cap even? Like 1.5?
Yeah. Like, realistically.
Maybe, you know, like, yeah.
Yeah. Realistically, like, two.
And that's a great season for him. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Whereas Burnes could potentially put up, you know, 4 or 5 if he's having a great season. So, yeah. And then, like you said, the other ones are, you know, who knows? Maybe they could even, like, not be a drag on it. Like, Wong and Teheran could potentially be, you know, replacement level players. Who knows?
I just don't see how they fit on that roster. But anyway, regardless.
No, I don't know how Colton Wong potentially like gets on that roster because they are they're
we have even, Joey Ortiz because they have too many infielders.
Right. We even with Joey Ortiz no longer on the team, they still have a billion and a half young top 100 prospect level infielders. So I don't get that at all. The pitching though, Tejeron could end up pitching for them because they've had injuries, and that is a legitimate concern. So I will give them that.
All right. Well, we're going to talk a lot more about other teams that aren't the Brewers next week, but this is a good little exercise to kind of think about ahead of that. So thank you for all the Patreon questions, everybody. A reminder, when you sign up to become a patron, you also get a shout out here on the show. And Ryan, who do we have that's new to the Patreon crew this week?
Well, he's either returning or has elevated from just a non-paying member to now a paying member. That'd be the cheese for Wilson Contreras's wine, which I do appreciate that
very nice. Much.
Yeah, one of my favorite usernames for sure. So welcome back. Thank you for that. Reminder, patreon.com/MKETailgate. As little as $2 a month gets you that question priority. $5 gets you the perk and the additional podcasts as well. So that'll do it for this week. Another supersize preview episode. We'll be back next week, as I mentioned, to kind of put a bow on this series, look at the rest of the NL Central and the league as a whole as we get ever closer to opening day. Thanks for hanging with us this week. Have a good week, and we will see you then on Milwaukee's Tailgate. Yeah.